Before that, Jennifer Pastoral, the Love Injection remix from Castles in the Sky. I'm DJ Firefly. You've been listening to Couch Dancing on WRCT Pittsburgh. If you missed a show, or if you want to get in touch with me, my website is at djfirefly.com.
Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we devote the hour to a recent publication by two of our co-hosts, Michael Smith and Jim Lafferty. One of the contributors, Professor Bill Mullen, joins us as well.
The book is titled From the Flag to the Cross, Fascism, American Style. This anthology is a wide-ranging collection of seven essays exploring the rise of fascism in America.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
I'm Stephen Rohde, retired civil rights lawyer and author on issues of civil liberties.
And I'm Jim Lafferty, a decades-long political activist and once the national director of the National Lawyers Guild.
From the Flag to the Cross, Fascism American Style, is the title of a recently published anthology edited by Zachary Sklar and our own Michael Smith. Co-host Jim Lafferty wrote the introduction. The book draws from seven key interviews with prominent socialist thinkers in the United States and Canada. They include Margaret Kimberly, Henry Giroux, Diane Feeley, and Bill Mullen. Bill will also be joining Michael and Jim in the guest seat. He's Professor Emeritus of American Studies at Purdue University and the author of We Charge Genocide, American Fascism and the Rule of Law. Chris Hedges, who is also included in this book, writes, quote, "When fascism comes to America, it will be massive recitations of the Pledge of Allegiance, the Christian cross, and the flag." We'll explore these frayed boundaries of Christian fascism, capitalism, and the assault on free speech and censorship, while also highlighting the strategies of community-based actions. Michael, Bill, and Jim, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much.
Glad to be here.
Thanks, Heidi. Good to be here.
Michael, let's start with you. Fascism has been defined as an ultra-nationalist and authoritarian political philosophy characterized by a dictatorial leader, a strong central government, militarism, the forceful suppression of opposition, a belief in natural social hierarchy, racism, and the subordination of individual interests to the perceived interests of the nation. And it rejects liberal democratic principles. Fascism is racist, homophobic, and misogynistic. It makes use of scapegoats. By this definition, is the United States a truly fascistic nation today?
Do we have fascism in America? Not yet. I emphasize not yet. We start off our book with a quote from the great German playwright Bertolt Brecht, who said, "How can anyone tell the truth about fascism unless he is willing to speak out against capitalism, which brings it forth?" Capitalism cannot make for a decent way of life for most people in our country. Real wages haven't gone up in 50 years. The minimum wage is $7.25 an hour. The three richest people in America own as much as the bottom half. People live from paycheck to paycheck, from hand to mouth. They couldn't survive a $500 crisis. The unions were broken way back in 1947 and are not much of a force anymore. Union membership then was about a third. Now it's down to 11%, with 6% being in the public sector. Starting with Clinton, the deindustrialization costs us 30 million jobs. People are in despair. Despair is what fascism plays on. But fascism doesn't come in a snap. It's not like turning off the lights. It's a process. I emphasize a process. And that process is going on now. So do we have fascism? Not yet. But Trump and the forces around him are consolidating power. There's a German word for it. It's called Gleichschaltung. It means bringing it into line. So far, Trump has brought into line the big law firms, the media, a lot of our judges, universities like Columbia, state legislatures, the Congress, and a compliant Supreme Court, which just gave immunity for all Trump's, quote, official acts. The system that we used to have of checks and balances is being destroyed. Trump issues executive orders. He goes under the theory of a unified executive. And just 2 weeks ago, quite alarmingly, Trump figured out a way to avoid the Posse Comitatus Act, which forbids the use of the military domestically. And he called in the National Guard, first in California and then in Washington, D.C., to scare people. He used the false pretext of a crime wave, which is literally not true. He now threatens to use the National Guard in other cities like Baltimore and Chicago. So the answer to your question, Heidi, is not yet. Fascism is not yet here. It's a process. It takes a while to consolidate it. We're not there yet, but we're well on our way. That's why we wrote the book. And I just wanted to remind people, the book is called From the Flag to the Cross, Fascism American Style, and it can be had from Orr Books, orrbooks.com.
Bill, the German scholar and political philosopher Ernst Frankl postulated that at the start, Germany was what he called a dual state, a fascist country. Explain to our listeners what he meant by that, what relevance, if any, it has to what is happening in the United States today.
Thanks, Stephen. That's a great question. I turned to Frankl because I felt like his analysis of the dual state very much helped us understand the moment that we're living in. Frankl proposed that under German fascism, there were two forms of law. There was what he called normative law, which was basically the courts, judiciary, the legal system that was meant to sustain the operations of capitalism. Then there was something he called prerogative law, and that was the codes of law that the Third Reich created essentially to punish internal enemies, to legislate racism, to deport unwanted citizens, to criminalize homosexuals, to stigmatize Jews, and ultimately to rationalize and give legal cover to the Holocaust. And I believe that what Frankl argued is that these two forms of law, normative and prerogative, under the Third Reich, helped to sustain each other. In other words, that Hitler's use of prerogative law to scapegoat Jews and to convince industrial capitalists that this was a good program meant that there was two sides, as it were, to the operations of fascism and that they were co-constituting. I think that's very much what we see with the Trump administration. We see Trump essentially trying to sustain capitalism. He's not using the same techniques, obviously, as the Third Reich. He's using things like tariffs and other modes of law. But he's very much using prerogative law in a variety of forms to try to win business leaders, CEOs, tech capitalists to his program. For example, the use of executive orders right now, which are being used to deport and criminalize what he calls internal aliens. That's a great example of what Franco called prerogative law. The executive order itself means the president is above the Congress or any other body who might interfere with his attempts to use law to carry out an agenda. We also see this in the attempted use of things like posse comitatus. Mike has talked about the deployment of troops through executive order in the name of fighting crime. This criminalization process is very much meant to do two things, I think, in this current moment. One is to, again, use fear and intimidation to continue to win and coerce people to the Trumpian agenda. It's also an attempt to crush any resistance to the capitalist experience that people are having right now. And again, this is what Frankl understood. He understood that prerogative law was a way of smashing down against anyone who might oppose the capitalist order as it was being expressed through fascism. He was himself a democratic socialist. He actually had a background as a lawyer in the labor movement, oftentimes defending Jewish clients against the state. So his analysis was a class-based analysis of the law. And the last thing I'll say about it, and this kind of feeds into other things that I talk about elsewhere, and we'll probably talk about more, he was really trying to expose what we call the rule of law as something that was highly manipulable, was always in the interest of the powerful, and could actually help open the door for fascism. We think of the rule of law as something that can just kind of put a brake on the possibilities of authoritarianism. He was actually interested in showing us how it was an active mechanism of advancing a fascist agenda. And I believe that that's also very much in line with what I would call Trump's experiment in fascism, i.e., how far can I bend the law, use the law, how prerogative can I be in my exercise of the law to advance authoritarianism? And again, I would agree with Michael, we're not to fascism yet, but I believe that these are the baby steps being taken with the mechanism of law to move us in that direction.
Jim, as you know, Trump won both the electoral and the popular vote. He was relatively clear about what he would do if elected. And since being elected, he has done what he claimed he would do. My question is this, and it dovetails with Bill's last comment. Can a nation democratically elect its way into fascism?
Well, that's a good question. And it's true that he did campaign openly on his war against immigrants, etc., the national debt and what have you. But he didn't get into any detail in terms of how he would go about doing that, what he was campaigning on. He's really at this point following the Heritage Foundation's Project 2025 report, which encompasses many, many more proposed changes than Trump talked about when he was running for office. I mean, when Trump was running for office, he didn't say to the American people, hey, I'm going to cut 12 million people off of Medicaid. He didn't say what he was going to do to the universities, as Michael was talking about earlier. He's had a power grab, really, of what would normally be the power of Congress. I mean, we have this separation of powers in this country. He's stepped all over that. He's refused to dispense money that Congress has approved to be dispensed. He's cut the staff of so many federal agencies, which hurts people. If you want to call Social Security, you want to call the Veterans Administration for help, you're going to have a hell of a harder time getting it now than you would have before all these massive cuts in the federal staffing. He constantly violates the Constitution's separation of powers, really. He's not a king, but he behaves like a king from time to time. His cabinet meetings, indeed, are filled with mostly sycophant praise, as he says, without contradiction, as he did at the last one. And I quote, I can do anything I want to do. I'm the president of the United States, close quote. When he sends the military in, has been referred to. I mean, he's had at least a dozen, I think it is now, declarations of emergency, states of emergency, he calls them. I think it's almost a dozen at this point. where he says he can therefore deport immigrants without due process of law because it's an emergency. You know, he's fighting the supposedly Venezuelan gang invasion, which, of course, is a myth. He can dispatch federal troops, as he did here in June, to here in L.A., where I'm speaking from, and into D.C. now. Why? Because, well, it's an emergency to quell protests and fight crime. Crime is down in both of those cities, and the protests are peaceful, of course. He can ask the Supreme Court for emergency rulings because he can't afford to wait for judges to debate his policies and so forth. It's true that he campaigned in broad strokes on some of the things he was going to do. In the details is where we find the harm that he's done to constitutional governance in the United States. Look what he's just done on the question of our own history and the question of knowledge of what our history has been in this country. Look what he's done to the Smithsonian, where he's had them rewrite so much of our history so as to temper those parts of our history that he doesn't want to have really told at all. He's done the same thing in our national parks. He didn't campaign on doing that. He didn't campaign on what he's done to the universities, wanting to even determine what their curriculum will be. He didn't campaign on using the excuse of peaceful protest around Palestine and Israel to make bogus claims of anti-Semitism and use that to strip millions and millions and millions of dollars from our universities. So while it's fair to say that he campaigned in broad strokes on some of the things he would be doing, the devil is indeed in the details, and the details were not something he campaigned on.
Michael, your book, and I have to say, it's such a contribution to what we're going through right now, and I applaud you and Jim and the authors of the various essays. You entitle it From the Flag to the Cross, Fascism, American Style. One of those featured in the books, the journalist Chris Hedges, writes frequently about the Christian right. What role has the Christian right played in producing what he says in your book is a fascistic Christian nationalism?
What role do they play? A major role, a major role. They make up the base of Trump's support. Remember, Trump got 74 million votes in 2020 and 2 million more, 76 million votes in 2024. Steve, I wanted to read to our audience a couple paragraphs of what we wrote as an introduction to Chris Hedges' chapter called The Rise of Christian Fascism. The rise of Donald Trump and his MAGA supporters has transformed American politics perhaps more than anything has since the gathering of forces of the rebellious slave owners in the South a century and a half ago. It's a sobering thought to reflect on the fact that Trump received 74 million votes in 2020 and 76 million votes in 2024. Trump himself is a hollow man, devoid of any feelings of human solidarity. Programmatically, he stands for nothing but his own self-advancement. Trump bragged that he could shoot somebody on Fifth Avenue and get away with it. He's a product of his connections to the mafia, City Hall, and the tabloid yellow sleaze media like Fox News. When she divorced him, first wife Ivanka said that he kept a copy of Hitler's speeches at his bedside. An allegation in her complaint was that he raped her. As a businessman, he was a con artist and a cheat. Although ignorant and quite obviously mean-spirited, Trump is an extremely effective orator, as was Hitler. He has an extensive following and makes money for the networks who give him all the time he wants on the basis that, quote, might not be good for America, but it's good for CBS, in the infamous quote of Leslie Moonves, the former head of CBS. And I just wanted to end with this final thought that we had about Trump. Consequently, millions of followers are ignorant and support Trump regardless of the harm he will do them. His denial of man-made climate change is already leading to human extinction. These are cult supporters of Trump. They don't merely support him politically. They venerate him. When Trump was running back in 2016, he was caught on a hot mic talking about what he could do to women. And we have a comparison I think we could make to show that Trump is more than a politician, that he's a cult figure. I want to compare Trump to the hapless Gary Hart. Some of our listeners may remember that Gary Hart was a senator from Colorado and years ago he was running in 1988. He was running for president. He was tall, handsome, articulate, a liberal, a very popular guy. And here's what happened to him. He was on a yacht with a lovely woman named Donna Rice. A photographer caught them and snapped a photograph of the two of them. And in the photograph, he captured the name of the yacht. The yacht was called Monkey Business. That photograph was flashed all over the country. And Gary Hart was a dead dog. He didn't run for president. But Trump is different. And that's why I think that it's more than just a politician like Hart. He's a cult figure. He's always given a pass. He was caught messing around with the porn star Stormy Daniels while his wife was sitting at home waiting for him. He's all wrapped up in the Epstein scandal, but I believe he's going to get away with it. He stiffed his suppliers when they built his resorts in New Jersey. He was caught making fun of disabled reporters. All this goes by the boards because he's not a normal politician. He's a cult figure. And I wanted to end with this thought. Chris Hedges says, you can't talk people out of supporting Trump. You can't talk them out of it. What you need to do is present them with a program that will help them. Like Mamdani, his program of free buses, childcare, rent freezes, taxing the rich. Or like Shama Sawant in our book, who as city councilwoman did a rent freeze and got $400 million in taxes called the Amazon tax and got an increase in the minimum wage. That's the kind of political program that we have to get and support, because that's what's going to defeat fascism, nothing less.
Bill, let's turn to you for a moment. Another author and a frequent guest on Law and Disorder is Richard Wolff. The New York Times claims he's the leading Marxist economist in the United States today. What is the relationship between capitalism and democracy?
Well, I think it's a very tenuous one, because as we all know, capitalism is driven by a profit motive, which presumes inequality. Someone is going to gain more than someone else. There's no reason to be a capitalist unless that's your motivation. Democracy is premised on the idea that all people are equal and have equal opportunity. And there's a massive contradiction between these two principles. I think what we've seen historically is that capitalism has succeeded by managing democracy in its own interest. And what I mean by that is, and we can talk about the current moment if we'd like to, we talk now about we live in an age of oligarchs. What that really means is that democracy's kind of been emptied out. We recognize that power and wealth have been funneled upward. Clearly, Trump is doing everything he can as an oligarch to evacuate what we might call civil society, stripping people of their individual rights. According to the 14th Amendment of the Constitution, to live in this country as a citizen, the right to live here in peace. It's a full-out, Trump manifests, I would argue, perhaps better than anybody in certainly in the 21st century, this contradiction between capitalism and democracy that I began with. He clearly is a person whose interest is a ruling class interest. And what I mean by that is he takes very seriously the premise that the only kind of society we can have is one in which there are powerful people on top and much less powerful people underneath. So that's one thing I would say about the relationship. The second thing I would say, and this kind of gets to Michael's point, democracy can be a real challenge to capitalism, but it has to be done by dismantling it. We have to actually get at the root of the profit motive and put people before profit. This was really, you know, Marx's insight: from each according to his ability, to each according to his needs. We must construct a society which actually is democratic, which actually applies the notion of equality at birth, which applies the notion that that all boats rise together. It's the exact opposite, really, when you think about it, of how capitalism functions. And so I say that because for me, as a socialist, I'm a socialist because I think socialism is the most democratic expression of opposition to capitalism. It really tears it up from the root, dismantles its hierarchies, dismantles its motivation, which is the upward mobility of wealth at the expense of the many. I really agree with Michael's point towards the end there. Our best chance of defeating fascism and Trumpism is actually a full-on assault on capitalism itself. This has really been, you know, this was the fundamental insight of Trotsky about 100 years ago. He said, only the working class organized can be a break on fascism. It must take power because fascism ultimately is an expression of capitalism. It's the expression of capitalism kind of run amok with that oligarch class having virtually all of the political power and control over social relationships. So that's the direction I would argue that we need to go to disentangle capitalism and democracy as we are living them now.
Jim, building on that, German fascism was an alliance between the very rich and lower middle class. Hitler betrayed that alliance with the lower middle class and its program in what is known as the Night of the Long Knives. Please talk about that. Do you think that the American lower middle class supporters of Trump are in for the same treatment? And why do they seem to vote against their own best interests?
Well, yes, let's go back over that a little bit. One is reminded, of course, that Hitler's Nazi Party, for example, became the largest party in the Reichstag in 1932. It became the largest party in the Reichstag with only 37% of the vote, their highest ever. Hitler was then, January of 1933, appointed chancellor. And then the Night of the Long Knives, as you reference, was a purge that took place in Nazi Germany in late June and early July of the following year, 1934. At that time, Hitler and the Nazi regime eliminated many of its political opponents, primarily within the Nazi Party itself. Well, we see what Trump has done, of course, with the Republican Party. Now, they haven't been assassinated, as was the case under Hitler, but they've been rendered mute or eliminated from the party itself. Trump has been doing the same. As I say, without the killings, he's made the Republican Party, the Republican Congress, totally subservient to him. He's been able to get rid of those in government not marching to his tune. His big, beautiful bill is a gift to his billionaire friends at the expense of the lower middle classes who voted for him. I don't think there's any doubt about who prospers and who profits quite directly from the programs of Trump and the Trump administration and is not the factory worker. He got 45% of the union vote, which depresses me greatly because he's hell-bent on destroying the unions in this country. He's already stripped, close to a million federal workers of their rights to have a union. So the effects of what he has done so far are certainly contrary to the interest of those who voted for him, other than the billionaire class, which is, of course, what it's all about. And as Bill was just talking about in terms of what the role that capitalism plays in all of this. Much of this, of course, in terms of the harm to the middle class, is not going to be as evident yet. It will be more evident after, sadly, the 2026 congressional elections. And that election itself, I think, will most assuredly be an undemocratic election, as are, frankly, the elections in America anyway. But and particularly so in the 2026 elections because of the racist and political gerrymandering, which will result in, well, more congressional districts being in Republican-populated districts. By the way, it's interesting to note in that regard, going back to Germany for a moment in the Reichstag, that the Reichstag, by a two-thirds majority vote, passed the Enabling Act in 1933, which gave Hitler, what, dictatorial powers to enact laws without parliamentary approval. And today in America, the Republican-controlled Congress says little or nothing when Trump takes actions that effectively nullifies laws passed by Congress, violating the Constitution's separation of powers. And the Democrats, frankly, are not saying much either. Let me close with a quote on this question from Bill Mullen's essay in our book, From the Flag to the Cross. And by the way, I think Michael mentioned that earlier, but From the Flag to the Cross is published by OR Books, and one can go online at www.orbooks.com, find From the Flag to the Cross, it's reasonably priced, find many, many other wonderful books as well on of a political nature. But here's what Bill says on page 70 of From the Flag to the Cross, and I quote, "One of the myths of American democracy is that the rule of law will save us from things like dictatorship. But in fact, German fascism and Italian fascism both used the courts and the law specifically to implement fascist rule. Some of that was actually borrowed from the United States. For example, German jurisprudence during the Nazi years borrowed heavily from American Jim Crow law," close quote. And I'll end with that.
Turning back to Michael, when a fascist leader solidifies power, is there any example we can find in history of that man being voted out?
When a fascist seizes power, is there any example? No. There is no example. Francisco Franco, the Spanish dictator, came to power violently in 1939, and he stayed there until 1975, and he died in his bed. Same with Portuguese fascist dictator Salazar. Hitler was not voted out of power either. When he was faced with military defeat from the Russian army to his east and the American and Allied forces to his west, he committed suicide in his bunker. Italy's Mussolini was overwhelmed by Allied forces after 21 years in power. He was killed and hung upside down by his heels in a gas station. So the answer is no. Once a fascist leader gets into power, we have no hope of voting him out.
Why do you think the American labor movement is the most promising countervailing force to a complete fascist takeover in America? Do you see some hopeful signs in that movement?
Well, going back to my earlier comments about the nature of capitalism, fascism has only emerged so far in capitalist states. And one of the reasons is because fascists understand how to use capitalism as a system to concentrate power. As a socialist, I think that the labor, those of us who work with our hands and we are actually creating the wealth ourselves that capitalism accumulates, which can lead to fascism. So the first step towards stepping away from fascism is to stop creating wealth for those who might become our overlords. Historically, the labor movement has lived on the premise that we are meant to keep as much of that which we create as we can. And I think we see some awareness in the American labor movement right now that this oligarchical system has ruthlessly extracted not just so much of our wealth that belongs to us, but so much democratic potential, which is now slipping away from us. I think that the No Kings March, for example, and also the recent Labor Day marches, which were done in conjunction with a movement called May Day Strong, which started last May, which was really a coalition of labor unions, trade unions, trying to use the streets to express their opposition to this oligarchy. I think it's called Workers versus Billionaires is the slogan. That's really, really important. It makes the connection between wealth inequality and power inequality, which are the ingredients of fascism. And it also shows us that working people are recognizing the value of not only their labor, but their political voice. And this is critical. To go back to what I said earlier about Trotsky felt, you know, that the only way to actually stand up to fascism was for the working class to take power into its own hands, to absolutely stop the upward movement of power and wealth if we had any chance for democracy. I'm optimistic right now, particularly in the last 6 months, that the American labor movement is stepping forward. And I will say, as a member of the American Association of University Professors, Our president, Todd Wolfson, has been very open about referring to Trump as a fascist and referring to the attacks on universities, the extraction of money from them, or the extortion, I would say, the attempt to control curriculum, hiring, admissions. That, you know, fascism has always turned to control of universities as a key first step in its playbook. It's been true even in recent years in countries like Hungary, for example, and Israel would be another example where the state's control of universities is all very, very critical to preservation of autocracy. So I think that my union has understood the university as a site of class struggle and as a site where the stakes of fascism are being played out and are really, really high. This kind of consciousness has to persist in the labor movement going forward, I think, if we have any chance of reversing the potential of fascism in this country.
You're listening to Law and Disorder. I'm Steve Rohde, a co-host, along with Heidi Boghossian. Today, we have the pleasure of speaking with our own co-hosts, Michael Smith and Jim Lafferty, who have edited and contributed an introduction to the new book, From the Flag to the Cross, Fascism American Style, published by OR Books. And we're joined by one of those authors, Bill Mullen.
I think it would be helpful for our listeners to understand the contents of our book. And what I want to do is read the title of the chapters and their authors for them. First chapter is The Rise of Christian Fascism by Chris Hedges. Then we have When Capitalism Morphs into Fascism by Richard Wolff. Then we have Unions Must Lead the Fight by Diane Feely, followed by Militarized Education and the Assault on Free Speech by Henry Giroux. Then we have our guest today, The Law Won't Save Us, Bill Mullen's chapter. We have two concluding chapters, one by Margaret Kimberly, The Duopoly and Liberalism Led to Trump Too, and last was the important contribution by Kwame Sawant called A Fighting Strategy for Community-Based Action. That's the content of our book.
Jim, Chris Hedges has said that, quote, it's all over, they've won. He said this, however, before Zohran Mamdani's victory in the New York City mayoral primary. Do you think that victory is a sign of hope? And what about Kashama Sawant's victories running for the City Council of Seattle?
Both of those are indeed hopeful signs of what can be done and what has been done. But let me start by simply saying, no, I do not think it is all over by any means. I don't think the authoritarians have won the victory permanently in any sense. I do think they are now winning. And if the resistance to Trump's fascist behavior and actions dissipates or collapses, then it can be said or will be said then that it'll be all over, at least for the foreseeable future. But things change. Things change. There are any number of examples in this country's history of how hateful and repressive actions being overcome, slavery itself, the period of McCarthyism, the old Jim Crow South, the persecution of the LGBTQ plus community, the repression of women, the war in Vietnam, for heaven's sakes. But achieving freedom and justice is indeed a constant struggle. And it can fairly be said that the current crisis is certainly the gravest we've faced perhaps as a nation in many a time. And it could also be said that there, though, is already 8 months, only 8 months into Trump's second term, tremendous resistance to what he and his cronies are doing. Millions of people, literally millions of people have been in the streets and over again protesting what he is doing and has done. Even the militarized immigration actions are met with bold and often effective resistance. Already, as has been mentioned, a number of union leaders have supported the idea of a call for a general strike. Now you mentioned Mamdani's surprise victory in New York and the repetitive victories of Kashama Sawant for city council in Seattle. These, again, as I say, are tremendously hopeful signs. The mayoral campaign of Mamdani is a sign that people are starting to realize, very simply, that their best interests lie with supporting anti-capitalist, openly anti-capitalist candidates for office. Polls show, for example, that younger Americans are more supportive of a socialist economic system for America than the current capitalist one. And more voters are choosing to be independent rather than Democratic or Republican Party voters. The history of free speech and the right to protest and the massive exercise of both are part of the political mindset of the American people. And at least so far, the American people have demonstrated their refusal to give up those rights in the face, I should say, of Trump's dictatorial and repressive dictates. So it's not all over at all. In fact, as I say, the resistance is demonstrating itself to be strong, very much alive, and very much willing to continue to take on the battle against the fascist Donald Trump.
Bill, part of that resistance is coming in the courts. I believe over 400 lawsuits have been filed against the Trump administration. Over 200 injunctions have been granted. But I've said elsewhere, and you in your book say that you can't count on the courts. They may be necessary, but not sufficient. Share your thoughts on that, please.
Sure. Well, I'll start with something Michael said earlier, which is I think that the only way we really get rid of a dictator or a Trumpian figure is through mass means. We're not going to legislate him away. We're not going to elect him away, I don't think. And that's really been historically true. It means that there are limits to what the law can do to help us in a situation like this. And it's, as I talk about in my book, it's also true that very often the law can be our enemy in a situation like this. And that's the moment we live in. And Jim was talking about the Enabling Act of 1933 that kind of turned Hitler loose to do what Franco called prerogative law. Trump's control of the Supreme Court and arrangement of the Supreme Court is kind of an enabling law. And what I mean by that is that's meant to be the final check on his power. So far, it's done almost nothing but extend his power and affirm this theory of the executive branch as holding absolute power. Most American, I raised the example that Jim cited of the influence of Jim Crow law and race law in the United States on the Third Reich. The history of race law in this country is coming back to haunt us right now. Trump is using that 14th Amendment, that attempt to overturn birthright citizenship, to appeal to his white supremacist base that wants to see anyone who's born in the United States to an immigrant not be able to have citizenship. The root of this is race law. The 14th Amendment was put into place because black people and slaves could not be citizens because of slavery up until the passing of the 14th Amendment. So there's a boomerang, right, effect of the law coming back right now against, Trump is using it against ourselves and our attempt to hold democracy. The other thing I would say about the law, and this is a kind of a Marxist perspective, most what we call rule of law is meant to protect private property. If you open up any, you know, penal code in the United States, the vast majority of laws are going to be about things like stealing money and fraud and counterfeit and petty theft and pickpocketing. It's really the law as it's developed in capitalist states is 9 times out of 10 meant to guarantee that the system of capitalism is protected at all costs. I would argue right now that the legal system is kind of in a polarized mode where it is much of the legal system is actually doing the work of protecting Trump, because historically, as a capitalist leader, he has merited that kind of protection, also being president of the United States. There is a countervailing force, obviously, which is in the complex legal arrangement of the United States, which has federal, state, local law. We are seeing that tension play out. It's not clear which way it's going to fall. And I wouldn't also say, to larger discussion, I wouldn't say necessarily that the law is playing no role. I mean, every revolutionary knows. Angela Davis said, some days you have to call for burning down the courthouse. Some days you have to go to court to defend yourself. We are stuck with a system which we have to use to try to adjudicate our freedom. And I believe at the end of the day, what I would argue we need to do is create a society which is actually based on an understanding of social justice, which is not about protecting private property, but which is about putting everyone in our society on an equal footing.
Michael, on Monday, August 26, Trump signed an executive order creating a mobile force of 600 people to crack down on protesting in virtually any American city. The week prior, he offered a $50,000 signing bonus and forgiveness of student loans for young people who sign up with ICE. What is your reaction to this?
This is a giant step in the wrong direction. They tried to do something like this in 2006 when it was proposed that the National Guard from one state could be used by the president and sent to another state without the express consent of either governor of either state. They couldn't get away with it. So now the Trump people figured out a way to get around it. They used the National Guard in Washington, D.C., which is governed directly by the federal government and not by a mayor. Trump sent troops to Washington. Now there are troops in Washington from South Carolina and Mississippi, and they can send them anywhere to other cities across the country. So Trump is now threatening Baltimore and Chicago. And I'd like to hear the reaction of some of our guests on what it means that he's doing this and what people can do about it.
Jim, Trump has subdued institutions that might stand in his way. We just heard comments regarding the Supreme Court. We know that major law firms have capitulated. Universities like Columbia have, in large measure. Public broadcasting is being demolished, and major media are largely falling in line. Looking at that whole set of institutions, how do you evaluate that?
Well, it's very sad, but it's not at all surprising. I don't think it's surprising at all that in a, you know, bottom line capitalist society economy like ours, that our institutions who want federal support, including colleges and universities who depend a lot on federal support, that they would agree to unreasonable demands from Trump to keep their federal dollars flowing is, I suppose, sad, certainly, but not terribly surprising. Or in the case of some of the nation's biggest law firms, they've caved in many cases so that they can still have access to federal courts, even though it means agreeing to do millions of dollars of free legal work for Trump. It's shameful, of course. And indeed, those colleges that have stood and fought, and those big law firms that fought and didn't cave, have been winning their victories. So it shows there wasn't a need to do that when you fight back. What, of course, should have been the response of all of them is what some of them have said. They've said no, they went to court, they're winning the battles in court. What Trump really has tried to do, of course, is what a dictator would do. And that's crippled those institutions that are likely to be challenging his ideas. Institutions like colleges and universities that champion free thought, that weaken attorneys' will to present those and represent those who challenge the dictator's power. That's something you don't do under a fascist country. But the big law firms in this country that stood their ground are still able to do just that. It's really not surprising, I suppose, that Trump has done what he has done. He is a would-be king or dictator like those who drafted the infamous, as I mentioned before, Project 25 document, want to weaken any and all institutions that pose any material or intellectual threat to his rule, to his regime. In the case of what he's been doing with colleges and universities, he used the excuse that our nation's top institutions of higher learning were what? Hotbeds of anti-Semitism because of their campus protests against what Israel is doing in Palestine. Well, that's just nonsense, of course. The demonstrations were generally organized by or in conjunction with the group Jewish Voice for Peace, hardly an anti-Semitic group. Demonstrations have been largely peaceful on these campuses. But such demonstrations were nevertheless of course, in opposition to Trump's and the United States' military, financial, and political support for Israel. Really, quite simply, I think Trump has and is prepared to continue, when he can, taking dictatorial action against any and all U.S. institutions that don't simply march to his tune. But what is it now? He's up to, I think, nearly $500 billion in congressionally appropriated funds that he's held up and hasn't allowed to be used as Congress intended. And also, you mentioned, I think, public radio. Certainly, that's very much in our mind here at Law and Disorder. Look what he's done, said Congress, do in respect to public radio in America. The drastic cut in financial support for our nation's public radio stations is truly shameful. His crippling effect on smaller and rural community public radio stations is going to be profound. It's simply a lie that public radio is a bastion, you know, of liberal broadcasting. And anybody who listens to it, as I do, and as so many, many millions of Americans do, know that's the case. Public radio stations, for heaven's sakes, go out of their way to present balanced programming and news reporting. The effect of this cutback and this federal money, especially in rural areas, is going to be to deprive residents in some cases, of the only reliable information they get on coming tornadoes or on such matters in the news as to the well-being, it affects the well-being of those living in those areas. Well, our own show, this show, now airs on, what is it, close to 200 stations, I'm proud to say, mainly public radio stations in America. Many of them are in rural America. Well, the real reason that the Congress voted, of course, to slash public radio funding is because the reactionary Congress and Trump don't want all sides. It's not that it's one liberal side that's being presented. They don't want that side. They don't want all sides being reported. They'd rather leave journalism in America to the corporate media, which is hardly presenting both sides fairly. They don't want free journalism practice in America. And the sad fact is this: no democracy can long survive where there is no free press reporting the facts and the news to the people of that democracy. So until public radio is fully funded again here in these United States, all who care about democracy and a free press should dig a little deeper. We're going to have to dig a little deeper in our pockets when the local public radio station is having a fund drive. And we thank those who listen to our show and urge them to continue to support their local public station wherever they may be listening.
Bill, Jim, and Michael, this has been a wonderful hour. We thank you so much for publishing your fine book, From the Flag to the Cross. Now, how can people get a hold of it? Jim mentioned the OR site. Are there other venues you recommend?
Get it directly from the publisher. If you get it from Amazon, the publisher makes about 10%. Amazon, as we all know, is a ripoff. OrBooks.com, get it from OrBooks. I want to remind people that Paul Buell said in his first review of our book, it's an eminently useful book. I hope it will be widely read. OrBooks.com.
I echo, of course, what Michael has said. It's a very readable book. It's not a terribly long book. It's something that one will learn a great deal about, not only the history of fascism, but come to understand why that is developing in this country, but can yet be stopped. It's a book that provides both the history of it and the way in which we defeat the coming fascism in America. So From the Flag to the Cross should be on everybody's reading list, and it can be purchased for a very low price at orbooks.com.
I'll just add my thanks to Mike and Jim for putting the book together and including me in it. For me, the book is a wonderful toolkit to fight this current creeping fascism. And it's also a great reminder that how powerful ideas are and that we have to protect ideas and thought if we have a chance of actually materially changing the course of the history that we're trying to change right now.
You're right, Bill. This book is a how to do it course and how to fight the coming fascism so that we can indeed defeat it.
Well, once again, thank you, Bill, Jim, and Michael, for this important book and for joining us on Law and Disorder. Bye-bye.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org. One word, lawanddisorder.org. Thank you. is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we talk about the very important development in the USA, the explosive growth of the Democratic Socialists of America and the convention they recently had in Chicago.
Historian Paul LeBlanc is our guest. He attended the convention and he reports on what he saw and heard.
We rebroadcast a segment of the interview that I, Michael Smith, and Michael Ratner did with the great attorney Mel Wolfe, who died several years ago at age 96.
Attorney Mel Wolfe successfully argued 5 cases before the U.S. Supreme Court and then served for 15 years as the legal director of the ACLU.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm Jim Lafferty, a decades-long political activist and once the national director of the National Lawyers Guild. In a remarkable come-from-behind victory in the Democratic primary over disgraced former New York Governor Andrew Cuomo, the Democratic Socialist candidate, Zoran Mandani, is likely to become the next mayor of New York City in November's election. This comes a decade after the Democratic Socialist of America, the DSA, exploded onto the stage of U.S. politics. The organization is full of vibrant campaigns, discussions, and experimentation. For example, how can Democratic Socialists build a working-class political alternative powerful enough to defeat Trump's authoritarian regime? How should it relate to the pro-capitalist Democratic Party? What strategy can revive the labor movement? And what is its vision of democratic socialism, and how does it get there? To answer those questions and others, we speak today with DSA member Paul LeBlanc, who recently attended DSA's biannual convention in Chicago. Mr. LeBlanc is a retired professor of history from La Roche University in Pittsburgh, and he has been active in movements for human rights and economic justice for over 6 decades now. Currently, Mr. LeBlanc is a member of Democratic Socialists of America, of Solidarity, and of the Tempest Collective. He has written and edited many books, including the book A Short History of the U.S. Working Class. And many of Mr. LeBlanc's recent articles are online in Cumanus and in Links, the International Journal of Socialist Renewal. Mr. LeBlanc is also a contributor to A User's Guide to the DSA. Well, Paul LeBlanc, a warm welcome to Law and Disorder Radio.
Thank you so much, Jim. I'm delighted to be here. And for starters, I want to emphasize something. I've been a formal member, a paper member of DSA for several years, but I've been seriously active in my local DSA chapter for no more than a year. And this was my first convention, which I attended as an observer, not a delegate. I should say I decided to attend the convention in order to learn more about the actual lay of the land in DSA. And although I learned a lot, I'm still learning, and there's much that I don't know. And that's especially the case because DSA is incredibly dynamic. It's in the middle of a growth spurt from 50,000 to 80,000 and still growing. And it's been dramatically impacted and radicalized by the crises and catastrophes that we're all living through. And it isn't the same moderate socialist organization that Michael Harrington helped to organize back in 1982. It's not even the same organization it was 5 years ago. It's been tilting fairly leftward at the moment. So it's very fluid, it's going through changes, very much a work in progress. Anyway, I'll do the best I can.
That sounds fine, Paul. We appreciate you saying that, though. Paul, the organization Democratic Socialists of America, or DSA, did hold its convention in August 8th, 9th, and 10th in Chicago. Remind our audience, who may not be familiar with it, what the DSA is. You've already talked about the number of members, how many of them are perhaps really active members, how many attended the convention, and what is the demographic makeup of the membership. Give us some of that background before we go any deeper.
Sure. Well, it's an organization that's very broadly committed to socialism. There may be differences on how to understand what socialism will mean or how to get there. There are differences within the organization. Actually, the membership has been fluctuating over the past several years. So a few years ago, it was up to 90,000, then it declined to about 50,000. But now, as I said before, it's grown to more than 80,000. Some of the things that have caused that, well, one is Trump's second term victory. Another is Zohran Mamdani's win in the Democratic Party's New York City mayoral primary. And then, of course, there's the genocide in Palestine, which is another key factor in the thinking of all of the people who are at the convention and in the organization. Some predict that the membership is going to be rising to 100,000 before too long. But it's important to understand what this 100,000 represents. It's a paper membership, not an active membership. And I want to use Pittsburgh, where I live, is an illustration of what is the larger reality. In Pittsburgh, the paper membership has fluctuated around 700. Now, of these, between 400 and 500 have been members in good standing, which means they've paid dues. They're paid up. Of these, roughly 10 or 15% could be understood to be active. That is, they attend the monthly membership meetings, which are hybrid. They largely in person, but with an online attendance as well. Also, these folks are involved in one or another working group of the chapter. I've begun attending the monthly meetings in person, and when I'm there, I generally see between 50 and 80 participants at each meeting. This translates into a national total of, I would say, 8,000 to 10,000 active DSA members, which is still a substantial force. It's bigger than any other group on the left, the U.S. left at the present time. Now, then I can go, based on what I saw at the convention in Chicago, and there were about 1,500 people in attendance, almost all of whom were members.